recorded live.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Talking Twilight Zone.
You open this door with the click of a mouse. Beyond it is a world of sound, thought, and opinion. In-depth discussions of television's greatest blending of science, superstition, imagination. And you're invited along. For the next 30 minutes, we'll be talking Twilight Zone.
Hello, folks, and a very happy new year to all of you. This is our first edition of Talking Twilight Zone for 2011. My name is Lynn. I'm your host for Talking Twilight Zone. We missed a couple of shows due to the holidays and more recently due to a wedding, mine and Bobby's. Last Saturday, January 8th, Bobby and I tied the knot, and it turned out to be a lovely wedding and a very happy day. So I'd like to say hello to my co-host, Robert, and my other co-host and now husband, Bobby Neer. Hi, guys.
Hello.
Hello. See, Twilight Zone can bring people together. Now, remember that,
folks. It sure can. And I do hope all of our listeners had a wonderful holiday season. Now, today's episode up for discussion is called Nick of Time, and I'll turn it over to Robert for the opening clip.
And now, Mr. Serling.
You've probably run across these penny machines that tell your fortune. You put a penny in, and out comes a card. Only this particular machine is a little bit unique in that the fortunes that it tells happen to come true. A most intriguing tale called The Nick of Time by Mr. Richard Matheson, and you're invited to partake of it.
Thank you, Robert. And before I begin, I, as always, would like to welcome our callers and listeners, Dave, and we have someone called It's a Secret, and we have Kelly here today. So it's great to have you all here, and thanks for listening in. Okay, well, Nick of Time portrays a young couple named Don and Pat Carter who are on their honeymoon and traveling through Ohio. Their car breaks down in a small Ohio town, so while waiting for it to be repaired, they stop in a diner and get lunch and sit in a booth with a fortune-telling machine on the table that doubles as a napkin holder. It's called the Mystic Sphere and has a devil bobblehead on top of it. For one penny, you could ask this machine any yes or no question, so Don decides to try it for fun. And he puts in his penny, and he asks a question, and then another, and then another, and then another, until he becomes obsessed with this metal machine that spits out cards, which have generic but coincidentally appropriate answers on them. Now, he's up for a promotion at work, so at one point, he asks the machine if he'll get it. The machine spits out a card that says, "It has been decided in your favor." So he calls his office, and he finds out that he actually has been chosen for the promotion. It gets to the point where his wife, Pat, is becoming very concerned because Don is depending on this machine to decide for them when they can leave town. Eventually, after a couple of other coincidental answers to his questions, and Don thinking that a car almost hitting them in the street was predicted by the machine, Don's wife finally can't take it anymore, and she brings him to his senses. The repairman comes into the diner and tells them that their car is ready, so she wants to leave, and she insists that they have to make their own future, and they can't allow a silly fortune-telling machine to control their lives. So Don does wise up, and he comes to his senses. They pay their bill, and they leave. However, as they do, another couple comes in and sits in the same booth. Apparently, they've also been sucked in by the machine, and they're still trying to find out when they can leave town. Overall, I really liked Nick of Time. I gave it a 4 rating for excellent. Now, I said in my original review of the episode that superstition and a fear of the unknown, you know, can cause people to overreact and do crazy things. A lot of people won't admit that they're superstitious or believe in horoscopes and other methods of predicting the future. But I think most of us have some degree of a superstitious bone in us. I mean, it's the reason we can't wait to read the fortune inside the Chinese fortune cookie. Or the reason we avoid walking under ladders, or why we feel uneasy if we break a mirror, or it's even our excuse for keeping the bride away from the groom before the wedding. Okay, maybe we don't want to admit or believe that we're superstitious and fearful of the unknown, and some people may not have a superstitious bone in their body. But yet I believe that many, many people just simply look upon superstitions with the attitude and belief that it's better to be safe than sorry. Can't hurt to walk around that ladder or to keep the groom away from the bride until the ceremony. And who knows, maybe one of those fortune cookie fortunes will come true one day. But William Shatner, he played the role of the nervous, obsessive husband quite well, in my opinion. I've always found Shatner to be one of those very over-the-top actors, you know, always overacting, but he was okay in this one. So I give it a 4 for excellent. And now, I'm sorry, I'm going to turn this over to Robert. I don't know, Robert, I always assume that you're just knowing when to come in. Sorry about that.
Yeah, we're just trying to get back in the swing of things here.
I know.
In the first of the year.
It's been too long.
Thank you, Lynn.
Yeah,
I imagine you guys, you and Bobby, were careful with your wedding, superstition-wise, when you were mentioning that.
No, not the least bit. We were around each other the whole day. We didn't do anything.
No. They're older. That type of stuff, Robert, is when you're like 20 and getting married.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, Kelly, they do renew their...
That was my first marriage.
Well, you know, people do renew their vows when it's been like 25, 30
That's
years
right.
or whatever. So,
sure do.
Yeah.
They sure do.
Well, actually, I like this story. Of course, it has the William Shatner, not as hammy as, you know, and his other roles like T.J. Hooker and Star Trek and, you know, Boston Legal, and to name a few of the stuff he's did. And, you know, he was very, very well controlled in this episode. And I thought this kind of as the fun of it, and, you know, being from where Rod went to college at here in Ohio. A lot of people know he went to Yellow Springs, Antioch College, not too far from Columbus. And I thought I'd check and see if there was a Ridgeview, Ohio. I thought maybe it was a made-up place, you know, how some they, you know, make up certain places for their story. And in reality, there is a place called the Ridgeview, Ohio. And it's outside of Springfield, Ohio. It's between Dayton and Columbus. But it's probably one of those towns, from what I've seen on the map, it's probably one of those towns that you're in and out of in 10 seconds type thing. So, but I thought it would be kind of fun to try to hunt it up and see if it did exist at all. But yeah, you know, we in life sometimes fall back on old things, you know, superstitions, beliefs, and stuff like that. And Shatner's character Don seemed to do the same thing. Of course, you know, they're on their honeymoon, getting ready to head to New York and in love. You know, do you truly know who your other person is? I mean, you know, she had to have some kind of inkling as they were going together before they got married that he was kind of superstitious and had certain beliefs. And, you know, the rabbit's foot for one thing that was in the episode. So when they, you know, the car breaks down, had to be towed in, going to spend a few hours in town. You know, they go and get something to eat, you know, like any other person would do. And instead of it being like when I was a kid, we didn't have a fortune-telling machine at our table. It was the jukebox, the small portable jukebox where you put your nickel in and you pick what songs you want to listen to. So with this one...
I remember those.
Remember those where you had to turn thing and you turned them around.
Yep, you turned
like
it around.
B7
like
or
mm-hmm.
H1 or whatever the selection was. Yeah.
Turn style. Mm-hmm.
Yep. And, you know, that kind of got him hooked. And asking the questions, you know, about, as Lynn said, his job, is the, you know, car going to be, you know, fixed, you know. Is there danger? But see, the thing is, they had to be yes or no questions to, because these, you know, are very precise questions where you couldn't just say, you know, am I gonna win $1 million or $2 million? See, you can't answer that way. It has to be like a yes or no question. But you know, I think what really snapped him out of it in this episode was his wife, when she gave him the speech about, you know, determining your own fate and, you know, going out and not relying on some machine to determine what you do. And then, you know, you get the kind of the half-happy ending on this to where, you know, you see the fate that these two escape when this other couple comes in and didn't quite escape the fate they had. So it's kind of a lesson in a story like this. You know, today, as you know, as in the past, we throw salt behind our backs, you know, Penny's head up, play lottery tickets in hopes to win the big jackpot, palm readers to tell us what our future is going to be. I mean, we don't know what our future is until we make it. In the past, as in today, society, we look at others to tell us what to do. We read books. Remember the old 900 numbers you used to call? Call Cleo, and she'd be able to tell you what, you know, lies in your future.
Yeah. Oh, I think they still have those.
Yep. And to ask for advice, even toy makers took advantage of this with the Magic 8 Ball, the Ouija board for kids, or, you know, simply going to a Chinese restaurant, which is what I did today, and open a fortune cookie at the end of your meal to see what your future says. And, of course, the horoscopes and newspapers. You know, instead of going out and seizing the moment and determining our own path in life, you know, that's the situation that, you know, some people get into. You know, there's people that's willing to seize the moment, take, you know, their faith by hand, or to get stuck into the old superstitions. I felt that this was very much a self-contained episode, but a very, very enjoyable one to watch. And actually, I was kind of thinking when I was watching this of a few things that came to mind. I have one clip. If people remember the movie Live and Let Die, James Bond.
Oh, yeah.
And the scene Solitaire, played by Jane Seymour. And I'll go ahead and play that.
Black Queen on the Red King, Miss...
Solitaire.
My name's Bond. James Bond.
I know who you are, what you are, and why you have come. You have made a mistake. You will not succeed.
Rather a sweeping statement, considering we've never met.
Cards have followed you for me.
Now you get ripped off in Detroit, baby. You yell out to me. You hear?
Is he on? Can't be too careful in New York City.
He comes again. There will be violence. He approaches even now.
By land or water?
Water. Has arrived.
Good. Rosie's been more efficient than I anticipated.
I know a place where we could rustle up a car.
Beautiful, brave, and now resourceful. Rosie, you seem to be staging a remarkable comeback.
Tell me about the future. Is it death?
I said, is it death?
It is death. I see the intervention of a woman.
The girl was about to confess. We had to kill her. The trap was set. She was waiting. And you saw death.
It must have been the girl's death. If you do not ask specific questions, I cannot be responsible for your misinterpretation of the answer.
Of course, we know in that movie, Bond kind of stacked the deck in his favor for that situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But another one also, if a lot of people remember the old series Dynasty, there was an episode where Alexis goes to Italy and she confronts a fortune teller in that episode of Dynasty.
Two of cups over the six of cups. like very much, even though it is in the past.
What is it that you like?
Ah, the last couple of days here in Italy. Very pleasant for you. Spend it with a man. Old friend.
Well, he was more than that. He was my ex-husband.
You wanted him very much, huh? I see here. You still want him very much.
Yes. Yes, I do. Go on.
He too wants you very much. Physically. But no fulfillment, no lovemaking. Is that possible? Do I see clearly, yes?
Well, nothing happened between us, if that's what you mean. I mean, at least, not yet.
Yeah, it sounds like Alexis always setting something up. So, and my last one I'm bringing up is going back to the Twilight Zone series in 1985. When watching this episode, it reminded me of one called The Misfortune Cookie. Now, that episode had Elliot Gould in it as a food critic. In the 1985 Twilight Zone series, they put together, depending on time, 2 to 3 episodes together in one. And this was like the third episode of that set. And if you listen real closely, you may recognize the news reporter at the beginning.
Tonight, let me tell you about a wonderful little out-of-the-way Chinese restaurant I just discovered. Mr. Lee's Chinese Cuisine. The food is absolutely heaven. Very possibly the best in the city. It's in a little alley off Harbor Street downtown. Hard to find, but worth the effort, I assure you. This is Dana Duchal.
Mr. Lee's Chinese Cuisine. If you love your Pekingese, don't ask for a doggy bag. Is Mr. Lee's really that bad?
I wouldn't know. I've never had the displeasure of dining there.
What?
Don't worry, I'll stop by later. I'll need a matchbook for my collection. I have a feeling Mr. Lee's is going to be closing rather soon.
But that's not ethical, Harry. And it's not fair to the restaurant.
Dear boy, in the arena of restaurant criticism, there's only excellent and poor. There's no such thing as fair.
I cannot ask you to pay for a dinner you did not like. There is no check. Only this. My heritage is rich with the tradition of preparing and serving food for others. If someone has not enjoyed something I have served, then I must make amends. I bring you one very special fortune cookie for our most very special customers only. I hope it will please you, and you will come back again.
A grand reward awaits you just around.
Okay?
They're all here.
$100,000 worth of diamonds, 2 armed security guards, and what happens? Some punk junkie runs up and grabs the bag like it's nothing. Mister, you're a lifesaver. You deserve a reward. I'm going to give you the $1,000 these clowns were supposed to have.
What?
Hey, wait a minute.
Oh, shut up. These guys were due for a bonus of $1,000. I want to give it to you. Come on back to my office. I want to give you your reward.
So he gets his reward, which was stated in the fortune cookie. Unfortunately for the film critic that decided to cause problems for Mr. Lee, eternal hunginess ended up with him. So just desserts in that situation. So 4 out of 5 for pick a time. So I pass on to Bobby.
Who's the lady, by the way?
Linda Hamilton. Linda Hamilton.
I would have never recognized her. Yeah.
Yeah. She was wearing like a real blonde wig, and you could tell by the voice that it was Linda Hamilton.
Okay, Bobby.
All right. I only want to know one thing from that fortune-telling machine. I'd like to know how much it's going to cost 50 years later. It's certainly not going to cost a penny, that's for sure.
Uh-huh.
I know of nothing that costs a penny today. I completely disagree about William Shatner being calm or reserved in this episode. You don't want him to be calm or reserved in this episode. That's the whole point. And one thing's for sure, I mean, I personally like Shatner, and I think he takes a lot of heat for his acting and for his histrionics and his over-the-top behavior. But, I mean, that's been his entire career, and I don't find anything wrong with it particularly. And his two appearances in The Twilight Zone, he was picked deliberately for that. That's obvious. In this one and in the other more famous one when he's on the plane, he does exactly what he's supposed to do. I can't think of anybody else I'd rather have in there. He may have been a little restrained considering how he normally is, but the whole point is he's supposed to be out of control, so I wouldn't want anybody else in there except for Shatner. The thing that gets to me about fortune-telling machines or fortune tellers or any of that, or the need or the desire to know what the future is that you can't do a damn thing about it, so it doesn't prove anything. Suppose you did know what was going to happen. Suppose you asked a fortune teller or a machine whether you were going to get that promotion you thought you were going to get, and it tells you no. Exactly what are you going to do about it? You're not going to be able to change anything. So other than just curiosity, it really proves precious little to know what the future holds. It's just a waste of time. You just have to live your life out and see what happens. There may be a few things you could, obviously, if a fortune teller told you not to get on a plane because it was going to crash and then it did, then you save your life. But I don't buy into any of that. I'm a fatalist, so I don't think it's just a waste of time to be fooling around with this nonsense about knowing what the future holds. The story is pretty good. I gave it a 4. I wouldn't call it a classic or anything near it. It keeps your interest. It's not terribly compelling to watch a man sticking pennies in a machine. But for what it is, it's pretty good. You can see the ending coming. You surely know that after they decide to walk out, there's got to be somebody else who's had the same problem because the machine is sitting there. I thought it might have been a more interesting ending, actually, to have everybody leave the diner and have the owner of the diner come over and open the machine and put cards in it as a way to show that the whole thing is just so he can make more money and bring people back to the diner rather than have
good.
This kind of
That's a pretty good ending. I like that.
Yeah, it would be kind of amusing to see that in reality, all he is he puts the cards in there because he wants to keep people sitting there buying coffee all day. But, it really isn't too bad. Actually, like a lot of Twilight Zone episodes, it's not anything terribly new. It's really a throwback to the earlier episode, The Fever, where Franklin Gibbs was obsessed with gambling, with a one-armed bandit. It's the same story, basically, except it doesn't come to life and chase after them. But it's the same kind of story. It's all about being obsessed and getting out of control about the whole thing. It's interesting. Many people on the board and their reviews have mentioned that old toy from back in the 50s, the Magic 8-Ball, which was one of my favorite toys, actually. I used to carry it everywhere with me. I didn't really go to it for advice because I was just a little kid and I didn't need any advice and I didn't want any. But it was a fun kind of thing to use it. And I don't know, does anybody remember who wrote this? Did Serling write this or did somebody else? I don't really have
Serling,
it in front of me.
Serling wrote this one.
So I think, you know, anybody who had that toy was old enough to look at it, and this is basically the same kind of thing. But I liked it, and I thought, you know, like I said, I think Shatner is the right person to play this part. Because
I'm sorry,
nobody...
Bobby? Bobby, excuse me. I'm sorry. I was mistaken. Richard Matheson wrote this one.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well.
Yeah, sorry about that.
I think that Shatner is the person to play it, but nobody does a slow burn into insanity like he does. Whether it's in Star Trek or whatever it is, you know, he's good at that, and that's what he does best. So it's an interesting story, predictable as a lot of stories are, but I rather liked it. I give it a 4. It's pretty good.
Bobby, can I ask you something?
Sure.
What would have made it a 5 for you?
That's a good question. What would have made it a 5? Would have had to have been a real surprise ending, and I don't know what that would be. If I could come up with a better ending, I'd be a professional writer. I don't know that it could ever be a 5, really. I reserve 5 for things like Eye of the Beholder and Time Enough at Last. I think you have to be careful with The Twilight Zone, as like it as much as we all do, to look at stories and go, yeah, I really enjoyed that's a 5, because that kind of, you know, cheapens everything. No, I don't think it's a 5.
I agree.
My 5s have to be really completely over the top, and this is not really over the top, but it is what it is. It's an interesting story, and it holds up well after all these years. It's one of those stories. Some Twilight Zone stories are so old they look a little silly in the context of today.
Right.
But superstition is still around, so nothing really has changed. There are still people who are superstitious.
Yeah, I still pick those pennies off the street.
Yeah, I just think that, you know, if that machine is in a diner somewhere, it's got to cost at least a quarter a shot, if not more than that. And at that rate, you could go broke playing it. I don't know of anything that's a penny today. So they're lucky they were back then, because he'd have gone broke just playing it. All right, that's it for me.
We have another guest, Felix in New Jersey, and he agrees that Matheson is a great writer.
Oh,
so
sure.
Thank you for tuning in, Felix. And Dave, what are your thoughts?
Well, I quite enjoyed it. A few things to comment on. Firstly, I wish he hadn't said a little bit unique at the beginning. I hate it. Unique is unique. You're either unique or not, but that's just me being pedantic. I did enjoy it. I thought it took a little bit before they let on that the William Shatner character, Don, was superstitious, because it seemed to be that he was obsessing about this thing from a very early stage, and it's only about a good 6 or 8 minutes in that she then, you know, she's looking at this key ring with the rabbit's foot on it, things like that, and then you get the fact that this has actually been something in their relationship that she's perhaps been worried about before. And so that comes into that. I wasn't sure about this. I get some background, Robert. Hang on a sec. And I wasn't sure about this pennies business. Can you still hear me?
Yeah.
I can hear you.
I'm hearing a lot of background there somewhere. Okay. I didn't know whether this pennies thing was the fact that when he asked behind the counter for them, whether actually it was like the old currency. Because in the UK, of course, we have old pennies and new pennies. And I was thinking these machines were almost supposedly antiques, even at the time the program was made.
Dave, so they'd probably be wheat pennies is probably what they were using back then.
Sorry, say that again.
They're wheat pennies. On the back of them, they would have like 2 stalks of wheat. And it would say 1 cent on the back.
Pennies.
So
yeah,
they're not equivalent to 1 cent then?
Yeah, they are. But
yeah, a penny was a penny back then. A penny today is like 0.5 cent.
Oh, God. Right. Well, I think one of the biggest shocks I had was when he asked for the bill for his food and how cheap that was. But
yeah.
The other thing is, I thought they worked very well as a couple. I thought the young lady did a good acting job. I don't know why they dressed her so prim. I mean,
she looked frumpy. They dressed her real frumpy. She shouldn't have been that frumpy.
I mean, she was now a young woman, a married young woman, which, of course, that fooled me a bit when she was asking the question, will I ever marry? But, of course, that was her trick question. She was trying to prove to him that she wouldn't necessarily get the right answers, so she was asking a trick question. But they were a married couple. They were traveling together in the car, and she seemed to be buttoned up right to the neck, where old William was flexing his abs whenever he could.
Well, I think that was kind of the way they normally portrayed women on TV back then, though. I mean, they tended to show them all buttoned up. Regardless, I mean, that was just kind of the way they were portrayed.
Yeah, it seemed very loose-fitting. I mean, she was basically wearing one of the tablecloths, wasn't she, really?
Yeah, she looked very frumpy. Rage, yeah.
But the point about it that I thought was good was the fact that we think he's obsessing, but of course it turns out that he's right. The machine is telling you the fortune. The switcheroo, of course, was the fact that the fact that it was telling the fortune wasn't a good thing, because that was what had trapped the other couple that, even though we're only on the screen a minute or two, made that great impression. They had the concerned and worried looked and harassed looked, and that sort of underlined the point about the oh dear, sorry, I'm getting an awful lot of noise.
I don't know who's
doing it's that. Robert's lighting up.
Oh, okay.
Robert. One thing, by the way, I didn't know. I thought Robert might have played a clip from the Tom Hanks film Big.
I thought of that too.
Yeah, as it goes. And one last little thing. I'll put a little link in the room, but I'll read it out for people listening to the recording later. If you go to a little page called www.b9, and that's the number 9, robotresource.com/mystic_seer, you can see how to build yourself one of those little replica of the machine that they were using on screen.
They also sell them, Dave. They also sell them already made.
Do they? Oh,
yeah,
indeed.
you can get them on eBay too.
Yeah, I thought obviously the reason why I had a devil's head on the front was for the pun in the title, In the Nick of Time, where one would have actually expected the creature on the top to be more of a soothsayer type of person. And when Robert was asking Bobby how could it have been a five, well, I suppose it could have been a five if the owner had gone over to the machine to fill it up with tickets. And the little head had talked to the owner saying, you know, and said something like, you know, I don't know, as he walked past, it told him to fill it up with more tickets. And maybe, and it had even got a five, if when you see the man fill it up with tickets, the tickets that go in are all blank.
Oh, that's good.
That could have been interesting.
So,
I like that.
So the thing is that it's actually responding to the exact question when it's being asked. Both, by the way, both William Shatner has already been mentioned as being in another Twilight Zone, and the Patricia Breslin, I think that's how you pronounce her name, she also makes an appearance in Series 4, I believe, No Time Like the Past.
Oh, you're right. Yes, yeah. That's right. I forgot about that.
Yeah, and that's pretty much from me, but when we get to the end, I just wanted to mention a little bit about Eye of the Beholder.
That's right, absolutely. And Kelly.
Okay, well, I do think this is one of the better ones that they've done, and one of the things that first struck me about this episode when I first watched it, in fact, the very first time I ever saw it, was that on the one hand, yes, it's a Twilight Zone episode, but on the other hand, it's sort of not a Twilight Zone episode, because in this case, we kind of have this rare occasion where the Twilight Zone was a Twilight Zone of the character Don's own making. Here it is, he's putting pennies into a machine, and what's so interesting about this machine, and also, as Robert pointed out, you had they used to have those magic eight balls for kids where you'd ask it a question and you'd tip it over and it would give you the answer.
Yeah, I had one when I was a kid.
I had one too. Although mine wasn't an eight ball, it actually looked like some type of like it was supposed to be a magic crystal ball. But it was the same concept. You asked it a question and you turned it over, and it had all these general answers. But the funny thing is that I was a little kid, and I certainly never took it seriously. I mean, you know, when I played it with my friends, we all just would laugh about it and just think it was one big joke. Nobody ever thought that whatever it was we were asking, that was actually what was going to happen. And so from that standpoint, you know, watching William Shatner on this with these cards coming out, they're such general answer cards. And what I thought was fun to see also was that when the wife starts asking it questions, she asks questions that doesn't even pertain to him. She says, you know, she asks him if they should leave to go to this other destination, even though they know that they're not going to go to that destination. And it spits out just a very generic, general response.
Yeah, she mentioned Columbus, Ohio.
Yeah.
Right,
yeah, precisely.
Right.
Precisely. And so, you know, you would think that that right there should have, you know, knocked some sense into William Shatner's character to say, hey, you know, these are just generic answers. I mean, he could have very easily asked the machine, am I going to get fired from my job? And he would have gotten the exact same card spitting out to him that he got when he said, am I going to get the promotion? You know, and it's kind of amusing from that standpoint just to see that he can't make that differentiation. And I've always thought that, you know, when people are like ultra superstitious like that, I always think that there's, you know, there's got to be just a real degree of insecurity in them. And I remember one time I was talking to a friend of mine, and she was telling me all of the things that her mother did. Her mother sounded like the most superstitious person on the planet. I mean, to the point of where she said one time they were in the car, and her father was driving the car, and they were going down the street, and a black cat ran across the road, and her mother freaked out and told the dad that he had to turn around and drive around the block because it was bad luck to cross the path of a black cat. And, of course, the father said, you're nuts. I'm not turning this car around. So she rationalized it and said, okay, I'm not the one driving the car, so I won't get the bad luck. But I said, your mother sounds really insecure. And she said, oh, tell me about it. And she rattled off all these other crazy things that her mother did, like her mother would never go to work on Friday the 13th. And so this episode really just reminds me a lot of that type of a person. And, you know, again, this is one of those episodes where there's really nothing supernatural happening. There's no space aliens. There's no good angels. There's no bad angels. It's just this guy has created his own little Twilight Zone. And what is nice is that at the end he finally does realize that he, you know, that he can take control of his destiny and just move forward. And the sad thing is that you see another couple that are just letting their lives get dominated by this little machine that spits out these little cards. And I think I like Bob's idea where it would have been amusing at the end to just see the owner of the diner come up just laughing as he's putting in more cards, you know, saying, I can't believe people actually fall for this.
Well, Kelly, right at the end, the Rob Sterling in the epilogue says, you know, they're leaving one of the darker parts of the Twilight Zone. So the implication by him, at least, is that they've had a narrow escape.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that's good. And I find it a very enjoyable episode. I gave it a 4, and I do like William Shatner's acting in this, and I do like William Shatner just in general in pretty much anything I've seen him in. I mean, right now he's on a very funny sitcom called Bleep My Dad Says, where he's about as over the top there as you can get, and he's funny in this show. And I agree with Bob, that's his style of acting. But the kinds of parts that he plays
if you've ever heard him do an album, he does albums where he talks.
Oh, yeah.
Like Mr.
Yeah.
Tambourine Man, Bob Dylan's Mr. Tambourine Man. And
yeah.
It sounds like, you know, he's like he thinks he's on a stage. He's going, Mr. Tambourine Man,
yes,
Tambourine
yes,
Man.
Heard that. That's actually kind of funny.
Yeah, he does a whole album where he does these over-the-top songs. It's unbelievable.
But I think for the parts that he does, that's the type of actor that they need. I mean, you know, I mean, like, for example, I know that when he did, like for this episode, you know, at the same time, a popular actor who was probably around his age at the time was David Janssen. You know, David Janssen played the fugitive. He was very brooding and quiet.
He was good in that one.
I just can't see David Janssen pulling off this episode Nick of Time the way William Shatner does, nor do I see David Janssen pulling off the other episode he does, Nightmare at 20,000 Feet, the way William Shatner does. I mean, William Shatner just is one of those actors that does do over-the-top stuff, and it fits.
And he plays
the
nervous wreck really well.
Yeah,
he plays a nervous wreck real well.
It fits for the parts that he does. And so I've never had a problem with his acting. I think if anything, he deserves credit for choosing the right kinds of roles that he knows he can play well. So yeah, this episode got a thumbs up from me, and like I said, I gave it a 4 for excellent as well. I agree with Bob. I don't know that this is really an episode that could ever be a classic. just because I think that it's just not a particular story that when I think of Twilight Zone that immediately comes to my mind. It's not one of the first ones that comes to mind. But it's still a very strong story. So that's my opinion on it.
Hey, awesome. And Dave, you wanted to you want us to hear your thoughts on the last episode, Eye of the Beholder. I'm sorry that you weren't there for it. So yeah, I want to hear your thoughts on that.
Oh, brilliant! But just for I didn't give a rating, did I? I should have said about 3.5 out of 5 for that last one. And
for
I should just
time?
Say, yeah. And the other thing is as well, it was quite well balanced because just as you were, you know, as the wife was swaying the husband. We were being swayed, and then just as you think, well, she's won him over, then the ticket comes out where your car is repaired, and there's the man from the garage standing there, and it's repaired, and then she starts to have some little doubts. But in the end, of course, his love for the woman brings him round, and he realises he's going to lose her if he doesn't go with her. But the very fact that that other couple are still trapped by it, I suppose it's still open to the interpretation that that's just a weaker person that just can't, or he didn't have a strong wife to pull him out of it, or
right.
Indeed the fact that there was something, dark within the actual particular machine. That particular machine was slightly cursed. Okay, what you're going to hear is me a recording I sent in, but it got lost in the ether, so my apologies. It's about 3.5 minutes long, and I hope it's not too repetitive to what was said on the episode, previous episode, Eye of the Beholder.
Fine.
Hi, everyone. This is Dave AC. Sorry I can't be with you live, but here's my audio report. Episode 42, Season 2, The Eye of the Beholder, aired November 11, 1960, and it's a classic. It's a 5 out of 5 straight off the top. It absolutely still lives as a brilliant, brilliant episode. In fact, it's one of those episodes that really gains from the fact that it's done in the black and white era, because it gives it that very film noir look and the echoes of 1984. The way the camera was held, the unusual angles, the way that the faces are obscured is absolutely brilliant in building up the tension. And the actress, should I say actress? There were two actresses, but Maxine Stewart, the lady who played Janet Tyler under the bandages, absolutely a standout performance. Every bit of nerve-jangling fear, every bit of frustration, every bit of desperation came through in her acting. And so it was a completely well-crafted, well-executed, beautifully photographed episode with that really dramatic chase down the corridors towards the end when we get more of the reveal of just what is actually happening. Of course, there's a very large underlying message in all of this, but I'm not going to dwell on that. I'm sure people in the room will talk at that at some length. But just to say two things. One, it was a really, really good episode, possibly one of my top 3 episodes ever. May I just point out one little Doctor Who related piece of trivia in a way. It was unbelievably good to hear that the lady's name, or surname should I say, was Tyler. Because in a lot of science fiction shows that I watch, Doctor Who and Life on Mars, the main character's name is Tyler. Of course, it was Rose Tyler who travelled with the Doctor in the TARDIS, and it was Sam Tyler who went back in time in Life on Mars. Oh, and just one point. Who was the gentleman that came to her aid at the end? The man who she was going to go and live with in the society? Why, he was called Mr. Smith, which of course, as Robert will know, is one of the names used by the Doctor, Dr. John Smith. But this was Walter Smith. It really amused me watching that. But let me not take away from the actual story as a whole. Extremely well designed, beautifully composed and constructed. And the actress who played Maxine Stewart was fabulous in the role. And just one little more piece of trivia, and I'm sure somebody else has said it, that Donna Douglas, the actress we see in the end without the bandages, of course, is best known for her role as Ellie Mae Clampett, daughter of Jed Clampett, in the Beverly Hillbillies. So that was nice to see as well. So I'll hand back to the room and say, yes, 5 out of 5. Bye, all.
Oh, that was great, Dave. Thank you.
I think I'd had a drink when I'd done that.
Well, that sounded great.
So was that live or Memrex? Sounded good.
Yeah, right? Really. It sounded like you were live.
Yeah, that was a very good recording.
Yeah, very clear.
Good.
That was exceptional. Thank you.
Oh, I was going to bring up, too, the actress that played In Nick of Time. They tried to persuade her to come back for Shatner's second one, but she wasn't able to come back, so...
And they're both still alive, of course. They're both still alive. Both born in 1931, so they'll both be 80 this year.
What, both actresses or William Shatner and Pat Breslin?
Yes, the ones from this week, Pat Breslin and William Shatner, both will be 80 this year.
I didn't know Pat Breslin was still alive.
Both in March 17th, and William Shatner, March 22nd. So,
Wow, and William Shatner is still doing a TV series. That's great.
Yeah.
That's wild. Okay, well, thank you for that information. All right, well, does anyone else have anything to add? Or we pretty much discussed this one. Bobby, you have anything left to add?
Not really. I need to get back to my football game.
All right. Well, we will be back in 2 weeks, and the next episode we're doing is The Lateness of the Hour with the wonderful Inger Stevens, who gave a stellar performance in season one in The Hitchhiker, and this one is The Lateness of the Hour, and we will be doing that 2 weeks from now. So I hope to see you all there. I want to thank everyone who came in today. We had quite a few guests, and I thank everyone for listening. Have a great new year, everybody, and we'll see you in 2 weeks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye, everybody.
Everyone, bye-bye.
Bye. We'll see you in a couple weeks.